We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Darius Miller.
This is Drew Hardy.
This is Lance Thomas, Tyree Gavin.
Jason Smith.
Anthony Davis of the New Orleans Pelicans.
You're listening to.
And you are listening to In the Know.
In the Know.
The Bourbon Street Shots.
Bourbon Street Shots podcast.
All Pelicans, all the time.
And now we are joined by the excellent Amin El Hassan from ESPN.com and a former member of the Phoenix Suns. I'm sure he's probably a little happy to be away from that organization at this point. Or is that true? I mean, would you like to be back with the Phoenix Suns on that team?
I think I'm far enough removed where I feel indifferent. I know last year you asked me that question and I was ecstatic that I wasn't there anymore. Now it's there's new management, and even when I go down to the arena and see watch the games, it's, most of the people there are new, so I'm indifferent. It's just like any other team.
I mean, obviously this offseason has been, I mean, there's been articles from you all over the place. I'm sure like any other fan base, on certain days, Pelicans fans have loved what you had to say, and then magically, right after you wrote a brilliant article, you instantly became an idiot. Because you didn't, love everything about this team. I guess I'll just start off with a question in general. How did you like this Pelicans offseason?
Well, first of all, let me just say, of all the fan bases that provide feedback after I write something or tweet something, I would say that the Pelicans fan base is one of the most rational, actually verbalizing their arguments in a mature manner, more so than almost any other team. I'm not saying that because I'm on this podcast and I'm trying to kiss up, but I'm serious. You know, you guys don't always agree with what I say, but whenever there is that disagreement, I always find psychological conversation I'm having with people, which always surprises me. I'm waiting for someone to come out of left field and say, you don't know what you're doing, and how did you get your job at ESPN, which is about 90% of the other fan bases are like that, and you guys aren't. So kudos to the cans.
Secretly, we all think you're a hater.
Well, I am. go ahead.
So, I mean, I think the one thing you said that I saw the most reaction to was your bold prediction about the Pelicans that you wrote about just recently. And that was where you put Monty Williams
right
on your hot seat list.
Right.
So explain that a little bit, because it seems to me that everybody talks about Monty, even like when they were in the midst of their big losing streaks, people are always like, well, Monty seems to be a great coach. So how could Monty Williams, who, by the way, helped hire Dell Demps, be on the hot seat list.
Right. So, first of all, Monty's a great guy. I don't know him personally, but we have a lot of mutual acquaintances. Everyone speaks very highly of him. He's one of the most well thought of young coaches in the league. But Monty came from a coaching tree, or was heavily influenced from Nate McMillan. And Monty and Nate both believe in slowing the ball down, limited possessions in the game, and playing at a very slow pace. That's what they did every year in Portland. They were in the bottom three every year. They were together in Portland in pace. And since Monty has come over to New Orleans, he's brought that philosophy. They've been bottom two every year in pace. They've never averaged more than, never broken the 90 possession barrier as a unit in New Orleans or in Portland, I believe. So when you look at this roster as it's constructed, and it's a team that is built to run and high octane and get out and get easy buckets in transition, and not really a grinded in the half court type of roster, there is an incongruence there. There's a disconnect between the way he coaches and what the players, the personnel that he has. So either one of two things are going to happen. Either these players who were built to play fast are miraculously going to come around to playing slow and play outside of their strengths and do it well, or this coach who has never coached fast, not even when he was a lead assistant somewhere else, is going to miraculously pick up this up-tempo playbook and relinquish control, which is really what tempo is about a lot of times. It's about how much of a coach do you trust your guys to go. And if your guy's always been kind of a tight grasp, it's hard to all of a sudden pull a 180 and then say, no, run free, take bad shots sometimes. It's okay. We're making it over the long run. And I'm not sure Monty can do that, and I'm not sure the players can play the style that he wants. And coincidentally, one of the reasons why you play a slow down pace is to have this illusion of I'm a great defensive coach. We're a great defensive team, because the lay people are going, and even, owners and some of the older evaluators in this league are going to look at points per game and say, oh, phew, they're pretty good. But, the smart people, the new age people, we all look at points per possession. And we know that limiting possessions is a way to make it look like you're really good defensively when you're not. And that's kind of what New Orleans has been doing a little bit the last couple of years.
Oh, particularly last year. They were terrible defensively last year.
So, obviously, you're right. He did come from Nate McMillan, but he also learned a lot, and his mentor was Greg Popovich. And there's that classic story of, Popovich and the Spurs got bounced from the playoffs. Popovich started watching tape, and he quickly realized that Tony Parker was now his best offensive player. And he spent the offseason, talking to Tony, telling him this would be his team, and that the team would be far more up-tempo. We saw a team that went from slow-down half-court basketball to one of the, highest number of possessions per game, highest-paced teams in the NBA. Popovich was able to do that because he saw that his personnel called for it. Is there a chance that, you look at Monty Williams' personnel, even when he had Chris Paul? People think Chris Paul is an up-tempo point guard, but he's really not. He's a half-court guy who had Peja Stojakovic on the wing and, Emeka Okafor and David West, two very slow big men. Back in Portland, it was a team, again, with LaMarcus Aldridge and even Brandon Roy that was, personnel-wise, would be more of a half-court team. Is there any chance that now, because the personnel is so vastly different, that Monty looks to what Popovich did and, is able to kind of reconstruct his philosophy because the personnel is dictating it?
Well, I'd point out a couple of things. First and foremost, comparing a coach to Popovich is like comparing a player to Michael Jordan and say, oh, well, Michael changed his game midway through and became better jump shooter, so everyone should be able to do it, right? Oh, it's because that's what he was dealing with, his athleticism. And ideally, yes, but in reality, no. These coaches are creatures of habit, and they do what they trust. And what they trust is what they've done. It's kind of a vicious cycle. And that's not pointing at Monty like, Monty, you're flawed. That's most coaches. You know, Mike D'Antonio, I think, is an offensive genius. I mean, really, really thinks the game on a level that most people don't think of. And I've always kind of said that when we look at NBA offenses today, not enough credit is given to Mike for influencing that. A lot of what every team is doing now is what Mike was doing when everyone else was trying to grind it out. But Mike is like that. I don't know if Mike has another gear other than the type of way he coaches. And Rick Adelman, with his high post offense and their corner offense, is like that. And Phil Jackson, it's just like saying, Phil Jackson, you've been running triangle this time. Now we're giving you pick-and-roll personnel. Do you think Phil Jackson's going to switch to pick-and-roll? No, you can say, no, the triangle works fine. And we're gonna make it work with these guys. And that's most coaches, I would say. And for Pop to do what he did, I mean, that flies in the face of, you know, decades of coaching. Now, most guys can't do it like that. You know, I could probably count Pop and Larry Brown are probably the only two I could think of who you can say, okay, I want you to run this, and then they'll run that playbook. And it's not, you know, they feel equally comfortable and confident in whatever they're running. So that's the first thing. The other thing is, it's kind of weird. You know, we'd like to attribute people to their influences from the past, but usually the way they've reacted is a pretty good indication of who they are. And let me make it a little clearer. So we had Terry Porter as a coach. Terry Porter was a guy who, as a player, his best success came playing for Rick Adelman in Portland. And he was an assistant coach with Rick in Sacramento. And so when we hired Terry Porter as a coach, obviously we wanted to get better defensively. And that was something that he was kind of, you know, he emphasized a lot in his interviews. But the other thing was, we felt like, okay, he comes from Rick Adelman's school. He espouses Rick Adelman's offensive philosophies, which we shared a lot with. You know, there are a lot of plays that we stole from the old Sacramento playbook in Phoenix. So we felt like, okay, offensively, he shares a lot of these beliefs that we have, but defensively, he'll bring us up to speed. And when we got there, it turns out that this guy was more identified with Pat Riley, with his short stint in Miami.
Oh.
And so everything was grinded out and half court and a zillion screens and eat up the clock and everything like that. Which, again, that may work when you have Alonzo Mourning and Tim Hardaway with no cartilage in his knees and Dan Majerle with his bad back and 100 years old. But in Phoenix, we had Amari Stoudemire and Steve Nash, and we played a style of offense that was number one in the league every year. You know, so there was no – I mean, you couldn't – even if the Riley way worked, you couldn't tell us that it would work with our guys because we already had the best offense in the league. And so – but the moral of the story there is, you know, you would expect, based on Terry Porter's past, that he would be kind of, I'm just bringing Rick Adelman's playbook. But it wasn't that. It was what he got from Miami, and he kind of did that in Milwaukee where he was a head coach. So bringing it back to Monty, yes, he spent some time in San Antonio, and yes, Pop did it this way. And I would say the first thing is not everybody's Pop, but the other thing is, okay, he had a chance over the last decade. I'm not saying that he had to be tops in the league in possessions, but there's absolutely no indication that there's any part of his playbook that can mimic or execute an up-tempo offense. If he's got it, he never opened that part of the book. So for us to expect that, what he's been in, this is his fourth season in New Orleans, and then yeah, it was probably about 4 years in Portland, I believe he was an elite assistant. So 8 years of coaching, of doing it the same way every day, he's going to throw that out. As a young coach, you know, a guy who hasn't coached much in the grand scheme of things, you know, Pop's been around. Pop was in Kansas. Pop was in San Antonio. Pop's been around. This guy was a player, and then he interned for a little bit, and then he was an assistant coach, and now he's a head coach, and all in the span of 10 years. And in all 10 of those years, or most of those 10 years, it was a slowdown pace. So everything from his coaching lifetime has been this way. To expect him to do it a radically different way, I'd be impressed if he does. Let me put it that way.
Okay. That makes sense. I'm hoping you're wrong. I'll say that.
Well, I mean, he may not get fired. The team may just be bad.
So, all right. So outside of Monty, because that was your bold prediction.
Yeah.
You've actually written quite a bit about different parts of the Pelicans. You've talked about Tyreek Evans and Eric Gordon and Jrue Holiday and Anthony Davis at different times over the past, you know, month or two on ESPN. I'm just curious, if you were told that one player on this team would be the difference between playoffs or non-playoffs, which player would you pick?
Anthony Davis, not even close.
Okay. So this is something that I thought was kind of fun. Anthony Davis is actually scoring. He has scored more points than anybody else in the preseason.
Mm-hmm.
He does have 7 games under his belt. Most people have 6. But he's also scoring at the 4th highest points per 48 rate in the preseason.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any chance that he continues to be an excellent scorer? Or do you think when the season kicks off, he's going to go back to sub-20 kind of things?
I think, okay, that's a tough question. There's a lot of different things going on there. Obviously, as you said, a lot of guys, you know, if you look at the Knicks, they don't play Carmelo every game in the preseason, or they haven't played him all game long. Even tonight, you know, Houston and San Antonio was on. They pulled Harden, they pulled Duncan, they pulled all those guys midway through the third quarter.
This is per 48 though, so it's normalized over the course of the game.
Yeah, but still, you still got guys that are, you know, I was talking to someone on Twitter the other day, one of my buddies, and he said something. I said, yeah, but it's preseason. He says, well, you know, some coaches take that stuff seriously, and I said, you're absolutely right, but the players don't. And I remember having a conversation with a player once, and trying to give him the scouting report for that night for a preseason game, and he said, kid, I'm just trying to break a sweat and not get hurt. That's a lot of guys in this league approach it that way. Now, young players, particularly if you're a sophomore, you're coming back after a summer of doing whatever you want to show your coaches, your teammates, the league. Hey, this is what I did over summer vacation. This is how I've improved myself. So they're going to go after it a little harder than, you know, some of the vets. Now, saying that, that's not a knock on Anthony Davis. I think what he's shown is that he's gotten stronger physically. He's a lot more comfortable. He knows where his spots are a lot more than he did as a rookie, which is normal, I would say, for most rookie players. And I think he'll be a lot bigger part of the offense for New Orleans this year. If you're asking me if he's going to be at the top 10 in the league in scoring, I'm going to hold my, I'm going to pull back the reins a little bit. And part of that is because there are other factors, you know, guys that he was guarding in the preseason that weren't going hard, they will be going hard. Teams will be targeting him. Teams will have seen him do this now, you know, after 10 games or so. Okay, he's doing this every night against sincere efforts. All right, now we have to redo the game plan and talk about what he's doing and take that away. Because a lot of times, I'll be honest, I mean, a lot of teams don't even do a real serious scouting report for a preseason game. They'll do a little skeleton thing, and then as you get closer to the beginning of the season, that's when you go full dress rehearsal, where, you know, we had an advanced scout there, we have all their calls, and we're going to go do a full shoot around. But a lot of times, early in the preseason, it's more about teaching your playbook, getting your new guys acclimated, finding your rotations. You're more worried about yourself than you are about your opponent, because the opponent is little more than a scrimmage. Someone who doesn't know your playbook and doesn't know what you're trying to do and is going to try and stop you. So for Anthony Davis, that's a big part of it, is how much of it is he's going hard when other people aren't, how much of it is he's going hard against defenses that really aren't geared to stop him just yet, and how much of it also is, will his teammates trust him to keep him the ball fed? Because that's going to be a big issue in New Orleans, I think, this year, is you got a lot of different guys who have offense on the mind, which is a little different from years past, where kind of had to pull together by your bootstraps. Now you got a bunch of guys who can all score the ball. How many of them are going to be thinking, okay, let me get to the 20-year-old kid, who is our best player, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, and if people don't know what Ryan's referring to, Amin actually did an article recently where he had, you know, was talking about some guys who could possibly be in the top five in NBA rank in the year 2018. I'll hold you to it, Amin. You listed a couple of guys who could be. One word answer. Will Anthony Davis be in the top five of NBA rank in 2018?
Yes. Yeah. If he's healthy.
You had to throw the caveat.
But I mean, with, you know, when you look at his body type, and maybe that's unfair, but that's going to be a concern for his body type versus the position that he plays. But, you know, in a perfect world where he doesn't get hurt seriously, you know, I think it's very rare to see guys who are that size, who are that, and I think I wrote this. It's not just his skill set, which obviously was born out of being a small guy and growing up late, or his defensive acumen or his IQ or his rebound. What makes him special, and I knew this from when he was in Kentucky, and I think everybody knew this when he was in Kentucky, is you're the best player on the team, and rightfully, you should be getting the ball every time. You should be able to do things on the wing and do this and that. But you have accepted hey, for the betterment of the team, let Terrence Jones get his. Let Deron Lamb shoot every time. Let Marcus Teague do whatever the hell he's doing out there. I'll do these things that nobody else on the team can do because that's going to help us win. And
Right. It's
so rare to see guys with that quality. You know, like I said, you can only, guys like that, who, I mean, really, you know, everyone says, oh, no, I don't care about the shine as long as we win. No, I mean, guys who really mean it. Who really don't care. Like, you know, I always go back to Manu Ginobili, Tim Duncan, Steve Nash. This kid is one of them, I say. He's got that, where he can understand that I can dominate. Like, he, as a 20-year-old, understands something that Dwight Howard at 28 doesn't. You know, Dwight Howard's caught up, oh, I need my touches, oh, I got to be, you know, like, oh, I don't like pick and roll. This kid is not that kid. He's not going to say any of those things. He understands. Which is crazy because I think he's also more skilled than Dwight Howard is. So if anyone has a beef or should be complaining about not getting the ball enough or doing it, it should be him. But yeah, he's special in that way, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I completely agree, and that gave the Pelicans a lot of freedom this off season to go get, you know, players who might be considered a little more selfish or guys who have high usage rates because, you know that Anthony Davis could still affect the game without touching the ball a ton. And, and last time you and I were on this podcast, I asked you if the Pelicans had an opportunity to zig while everybody else was zagging, while everybody else was holding on to these 2014 picks like they were gold. You know, I asked you if the Pelicans have a chance to move it, should they? And your response was, well, it depends on what player they get back in return. They traded they traded the sixth pick and they traded a 2014 pick, top five protected, for Drew Holiday. Did they get a good enough player in return to take that tactic?
Well, even before we hear these stories of Noel being out for the year, I thought immediately, great deal for New Orleans. I think Holiday is a special player at the point guard position. He's not the super athlete that Rose and Westbrook are. And while he's really high IQ, he's not the savant that a Chris Paul or a Kyrie Irving are. But if you look one step below those kind of names, he's basically the first guy on the list beyond the super elites at the point guard position. And he makes a really reasonable salary. His salary is not that out of control. So I thought it was a great deal from that standpoint. When you look at what they gave up, here's what I said. You know, Drew Holiday is, 22, 23 years old?
23.
So if you can find me someone in next year's draft, other than Andrew Wiggins and maybe Julius Randle, who's going to be, you know, as good as he is, you know, you'd be happy. You're excited about that if you found someone as good as he is. Now, you're talking about finding someone better in next year's draft. I don't think that's going to happen, particularly because that pick is top five protected, but I don't think New Orleans is going to be 6, 7, or 8. You know, if they do miss the playoffs, which I know I said they will, I think they're going to be 11, 12, 13. And that's kind of like the dreaded zone, the late lottery pick, where it's hard to get talent. And if you get talent, it's not going to be someone as good as Drew Holiday, even though, of course, he was the 17th pick overall. I mean, it's bird in the hand versus two in the bush in terms of that 2014 pick. Maybe you'll get something better, but odds are you won't. And this guy you know is good now, and you know he can do it on an NBA level. And you got him at a contract. Again, it's not the best contract in the world, but it's not awful. I think it's kind of commensurate with what he should be making. Now, the other piece of that trade, Nerlens Noel, that's kind of where it gets choppy, because I've had this conversation with other people, in that in some versions of the conversation, it's Noel that Philadelphia was specifically looking for. In other versions of the conversation, no, that's who New Orleans had on their board. So meaning if they didn't do that trade, Noel will still be the pick. If Noel was the pick, then 100% A++ on this deal, because I'm not a believer in him without the health concerns even. I think he's got a lot of unfair comparisons with Davis, and he's not that kind of player. If he's not the guy, then you need to point out to me who in the draft was the guy that they would have taken. Was it Macklemore? You know, again, Holiday or Macklemore, I'd rather have Holiday. And then moving on down through the list to other guys that were drafted in the first round, you need to tell me who it is, and then we can kind of talk about whether it would have been better to have this guy on rookie scale or play Holiday $11 million. For me, I was very comfortable in saying Holiday was a good deal for them.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think we're both in agreement there. I mean, you rattle through, like, who's going to be going 10th or 11th, and these are all names that, like, Gary Harris, who was, like, supposed to be, like, 10th pick last year, and Matrizel Harris,
yeah.
I mean, just,
Montrezl,
yeah. I mean, none of these guys are, like, earth-shaking talent.
Even they might be good NBA players, long careers, sometime, you know, really good performances, but they're not Drew Holiday.
Right.
And Drew Holiday's not, again, I just established he's not that great even in that context. But, you know, I think the problem is everyone thinks, oh, he gave up a 2014 pick. Like, it's guaranteed you're going to get Wiggins or one of the Harrisons or Marcus Smart or something like that. But even Marcus Smart is going to be a top five pick. It's hard for someone to convince me that Marcus Smart is going to be a better player than Drew Holiday. It's just tough. It's tough for me to envision that. And I like Marcus Smart, but Drew Holiday's really, really good, and I don't think we're giving him enough credit due. And I think, again, it's going to sound like, oh, man, this guy loves the Pelicans. The difference between me and you guys is I like the individual pieces, but I'm saying when you put this thing together, it doesn't look good. And I think you guys believe that it will come together.
I think that this is kind of I would actually go along the lines with saying I don't think that this roster is as locked in as people seem to think it is. Like, everybody seems to think that they're in win-now mode. They went out and got the best talent they possibly could. They have a lot of money now committed for the next 4 years, and that's a team. Hope they do well for the next 4 years. We called Dell Demps Dealer Dell.
Mm-hmm.
I really think he just grabbed as many good pieces as he could, and he's going to look at them as they play this year, and he's going to pick out the two best and keep them and try to move the other two.
Well, see, here's the problem with that. I think the problem is when you want to play that game, you can't overcommit salary. And the problem is the guys that you may want to deal are the guys that are going to be hardest to deal, and the guys that you want to keep are going to be the guys that everyone's calling for. So I love Ryan Anderson. I think Anderson is a guy that, here's the thing, if you look at the Pelicans roster, you've got two guys on the roster who are bona fide catch-and-shoot guys, Anthony Morrow and Ryan Anderson. everyone else is kind of either I need the ball in my hands to make something happen, or I'm a streaky shooter, or I'm not a shooter at all. So it places kind of an important – oh, excuse me, and Jason Smith. I apologize for that one. But Smith isn't on the same level as the other two guys. So it places kind of a weighty importance on Ryan Anderson. Now, Ryan Anderson is also probably your most attractive trade chip as, you know, an okay rebounding big who's one of the best three-point shooters in terms of prolific nature and a pretty good percentage. The guy that you most want to deal is Eric Gordon. He makes more money than anybody else. He's got a laundry list of injury concerns, starting with that knee. And he's probably the most likely not to be happy with the situation moving forward, right? You know, he was the guy, and now seemingly there are a bunch of other guys who are now leapfrogged ahead of him in terms of the important guys on the team list. So, but again, it's going to be, how do you move a contract like that with his knees and his surly demeanor? It's going to be tough to do that. And then if you want to say it's Tyreek Evans, you know, again, most people in the league thought that deal was a little bit too rich for their blood, you know, what Tyreek got. But, you know, you kind of brush it off if you say, oh, well, that's the only way we could get a restricted free agent to come here and make sure they weren't going to match. All right, that's fine, but it's kind of like you break, you buy. You pay him that much because you said, oh, that's the only way to get him here. You can't turn around a few months or a year later and say, hey, you know what? We really didn't need him. So you're in a little bit of a tough spot in that the guys you want to move are a little too pricey to move or, you know, or can't be moved. And the guys that you'd rather keep are the guys that people are going to be calling for. But I agree. I think Dell probably looks at the roster like you just said. You know, this is hardly from a finished product. But it's easier to say that and then to actually make the deal down the line.
So I have a question, and I think Michael probably wants to get your take on this as well. Probably 4 weeks ago, I would never have even mentioned this guy to you. And I'm wondering if I'm just being a sucker and falling for like small sample size.
Don't do it. I know where you're going.
Al Farouk, I mean.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going Austin Rivers yet, sorry.
Okay, all right.
not that crazy. Al Farouk Aminu. This is a small forward who has always been a phenomenal rebounder and completely clueless at most of the rest of the game and can't shoot a lick.
Mm-hmm.
He has been extremely solid this preseason. He's been hitting jump shots. Again, it's preseason. And I do remember that the Hornets, back when they had their big run in 2007, they lost every preseason game they played. So I don't know. Am I just being stupid and getting the hopes that, I mean, Aminu's only 23. Could he still make the leap? It feels like he's been in the league forever.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would be cautiously optimistic with him, but I think it's far too soon to write him off. Here's the thing: you mentioned his age. One of the things that I think has really helped him tremendously was playing for the Nigerian national team. Sometimes for players like that, you need to have enough different. You know, just sometimes it's playing basketball is what it takes. And playing basketball in different systems with different types of teammates and different coaches that helps grow your knowledge of the game. And from his standpoint, I think, you know, we saw last year come along as a defensive player. Definitely, you know, someone who can help out as far as rebounding the ball from the wing. And then we always knew the shot needed to get better. You know, part of that is just repetition and finding a stroke that works and sticking with it and being in the gym. And then the final piece, like I said, is the ability to play basketball, to experiment with these things that you've learned in a lab environment into the real world and do things that maybe you're not allowed to do with your NBA team just because of the personnel and the demands and stuff like that. So I look at Al Farouq Aminu, and I look at guys like Sean Williams on the Lakers, Errol Clark with the Cavs now, similar guys. He came in the league. Is he a three? Is he a four? We don't know. He's athletic. He's got these skills. He can do things in the open court. His shot is a little funky. And, you know, I think what we're seeing with guys like that is it takes him a little bit of time to figure it out. You know, we had Errol Clark in Phoenix, and incredibly talented. Incredibly talented. But with Earl, I need to tell him this. I said, your problem is when you approach a situation, you legitimately have seven or eight different things you can do and you have to choose from. Whereas a lesser player, a lesser talented player, maybe only has one or two decisions to make. And so it's an easy decision. So for a player like Jared Dudley, you catch the ball, you shoot it. At the time, you know, this is back in 2009 or 2010. For Jared Dudley at the time, it was catch and shoot. Should I put it on the floor? Should I, you know, throw it back and try to post up? These were all decisions that Jared Dudley never had to make. What do you do, Jared? I catch and shoot. I go over there and I catch and shoot. It's an easy decision for him. Whereas for Earl Clark, legitimately, do I shoot it? Do I take a dribble? Do I pump fake and let the guy come in and then go by him? Do I ISO? Do I go and I post up? He had all these things that he had to figure out. When he caught the ball, a guy just froze. He just didn't, and then would end up making the wrong decision. So Aminu is kind of, I always look at him as the same way. Like, he got a lot of natural ability, but really don't know how to play the game to the most efficient hilt because he haven't figured out, okay, this is the decision I need to make here. This is the decision I need to make there. And it was going to take him a little bit of time, and it looks like he's coming along. The shot is still, I mean, let's face it, when we go into the season, teams are not going to respect it. So he's going to have to make it before teams start respecting it, and then that's when the rest of his game can open up. And that's what we saw with Earl Clark last year. So when he first started playing, nobody respected that three-pointer. And then he kept making it. And then after a while, I was like, okay, we have to respect it. So then he can put the ball on the floor and showcase some of the other things he can do, like, you know, get to the front rim and then make a drop-off pass, which is something that I always knew he could do. But it's just like, if nobody respects your shot, then you never have an opportunity to do any of that other stuff.
Yeah, I think you were a little afraid that Ryan was going to ask you about Eric Gordon and his three terrific games in preseason so far and whether they could carry on. I won't go that far, but what I will ask is, yeah, you're right. If I were to just read all of your pieces over the last couple months, you say a lot of positive things about the Pelicans, specifically how much talent they have. I mean, they were number two in your article when you looked at teams with regard to under 25 talent. You had the Pelicans at two, and I believe Ryan Anderson was like 25 years and 3 months at that time.
Yeah, he was off, so he was off that article, list.
Yeah, if you did an article on 25 and a half year talent, they might have been number one. So you see the individual talent. You'd like the off season, but you keep coming back to, you know, Evans, Holiday, and Gordon. Can you keep those three happy? If they're winning, probably, but if they're not, it's going to be tough. I guess I would ask you, I guess the first part of my question is, for Gordon and Evans, neither one of those guys has ever won more than 32 games in a season. So what is the amount of winning that you think they would see this season as a success being, and they'd be willing to share? And two, if you're the coach of this team, how do you sell, you know, them taking less shots for the betterment? I mean, how do you sell this to this team with guys who are just high, enormous usage rates?
All right. So from the first question was what's winning for those guys? And to me, I think it's, you can put it very simply, playoffs. If they're in the playoff hunt, I mean, like in it, not, oh, well, someone loses four games in a row, and then we're right back in. And I mean, you got to be 7, 8, 9, or if you're in 10 or whatever, you're a game and a half behind the 8 seed. If you're in that kind of conversation, you got their attention. Obviously, if you're in one of the top 8 seeds, record-wise, you definitely should have their attention. If there's slippage, if the season ends and you're not in the playoffs, and it wasn't because of a couple of off things that happened the last week of the season. I mean, we're talking about March 31st. You already know, all right, it's going to take a miracle for us to make it. I think that's kind of the breaking point. Anything other beyond that is bad. I didn't get the quote at the time because I hadn't read it, but there's a quote from Steve Kerr where he talks about winning suppresses it, losing brings it to the surface. And everybody's okay with sacrifice, and everybody's okay with the team concept as long as we're winning, because that's what you tell your folks. So you tell your friends, man, what's happening? You're only averaging 13 a game this year. Yeah, but, you know, we're winning. We're doing it. You know, this is getting us wins. We're going to playoffs, and we're all taking turns. We're all okay with it. But if you're, you know, 35, 40-win team, you know, a good 5 games out of a playoff seed, then what do you tell your folks? Hey, man, you're only averaging 13 points a game. Man, they're screwing me over. Man, I'm not getting enough shots. And that's what they're telling you, too. Man, you need to be shooting it more. That's why you guys are losing. It's because you're only shooting, a couple of shots a game here and there. So definitely they have to, you know, playoffs, I think, is your barometer there. In terms of the other question is, how do you sell it? This is the hard part, right? And this is why, like I said, I started with saying a lot of nice things about Monty. Then I said, I don't think he's going to make it, because it's not easy. You know, I don't think, and that's why, by the way, I had a GM's hot seat, and I put Dell on that list too, because he didn't exactly give Monty the easiest, you know, grocery bag of ingredients to deal with. Ideally, in a situation like that, you want your best player to be a guy taking that kind of sacrifice, kind of like Anthony Davis did in Kentucky. It's easy to get Marcus Teague in line and Terrence Jones in line and these other guys in line when you got a guy like Anthony Davis, clearly the best player on the team, and he says, I'm going to take a back seat. I'm going to do the right thing so that you guys can do what you do best. And then when it comes down to, look, you guys need to rein it in, they can't say anything because the best player's doing it. It's what Pop does in San Antonio. He you know, gets on Tim sometimes in practice, so everybody knows, hey, man, if Tim can get it like that, who am I? In New Orleans, it's not that easy. You know, Anthony Davis is their best player, but he really doesn't have that stature on the team quite yet. Not as far as today. You know, everybody knows moving forward he's going to be the man. But today, on today's team, he's not there yet. So then it's Gordon, Holiday, and Evans. You can kind of argue Evans is going to take a backseat to those other two guys. He just got here. He kind of struggled a little bit in his last stop. These guys have been successful, more successful throughout their careers. But even then, that's, you know, he's going to only take so much. At some point, he's going to say, why did you bring me here if I'm only going to be paying this many minutes and not getting these shots and not getting my touches and all that? Obviously, you guys went out and acquired and paid me this money because you believed in me to do a certain thing. So who among those guys is the alpha male that the others will follow? And once we've identified that guy, how can he sacrifice, ironically, more than those other two guys so that they see he's the guy, but he's giving it up for us. So when we're asked to give up, we should do it so gladly because our leader is doing the same thing.
Yeah, I said it before to Michael. I can't remember a single team in the past 15 years that has basically gone out and acquired, because essentially that's what Eric Gordon is an acquisition because he didn't play that much last year, the three obviously best ball handling guards, offensive guards, from three awful teams, put them on one roster, and said, figure it out. Because we can say, like, you know, Tyreek just got here and Eric and Drew have had more success, but they're all 23. Mm-hmm. Eric really hasn't had that much success. Mm-hmm. Drew got to the playoffs once, but he was, even then, like, you know, probably the third best player on his team. That's how people saw him. So none of these guys have ever been alpha males on a decent team at all.
Right.
So I don't know what's going to happen.
It's correct. No, you're absolutely. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, the only thing I can say is Drew can say I've been an all-star. That's legitimate. And Eric Gordon could say, I'm the only guy here with a max deal. I'm the only guy here that someone thought of, literally two teams thought I was worth this. The team that gave me the offer sheet and the team that matched it. So in that sense, they do have kind of an upper edge. Tyreek Evans' scrapbook says Rookie of the Year, but okay, what have you done for me lately?
All right.
So that's the only reason why I kind of give those two an edge from a machismo of the locker room standpoint. But you're absolutely right. It's three guys coming from bad situations who got paid a bunch of money. So who's who? You know, who's the boss?
Jason Smith.
I like Jason Smith.
I do too. He's a great interview, actually.
Yeah. We had him 2007 and for player workouts, and he was one of the most down-to-earth, natural guys in the interview process, very open. And one of the few guys that, I don't know if he does anymore, but every time he would come to Phoenix, he'd see me and he'd remember me, and he'd always say something. Oh, it's good, you know, which is really weird because most of those kids, you know, you're talking about going to 18, 19 cities in the span of 40 days.
Yeah.
So it's, as you know, you see a zillion Amines, you know, everywhere you go. So for him to still be able to retain that, you know, for a while, you know, I thought that was pretty different.
So I got one more question for you. The center position, and we can talk about who's finishing, who, you know, how is Anderson and Davis going to coexist each other, but just the center position at the start of a game right now is being held down by Steemsma. Monty, like you said before, coaches don't necessarily change their stripes, and he has always been a stickler where he likes to have a big man in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
This team has Steemsma and Withy,
mm-hmm.
and Onuaku, and I guess Jason Smith, though Monty has said multiple times he wants that energy off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
How big of a gaping sore is that 15 minutes or whatever it's going to be? Could that be the difference between this team making the playoffs and not making the playoffs?
It could be the difference. If you... Kind of, it could be the difference if you want to play that way. You know, if you resign yourself to saying, if I want to play that way, this is not the best version of my team, then yes, that'll be the difference. If you think outside the box and say, I'm going to get away with Davis and Anderson up front, Davis and Smith up front, we're going to speed it up and do things like that. You know, Aminu up front at times. I think you can kind of overcome that for now. For if the goal is just right now, we just need to get in playoffs. Long term, obviously, something needs to change. You need either Davis needs to become, you know, steroid man or something and grow into that center position, or you need to go out and get a bona fide center, which I think ultimately they're going to end up doing. But again, I wouldn't. It's tough, man. Steemsma, if you're talking about 15 minutes, 10 minutes, he can be that guy. He's a very good rim protector. He's got decent footwork on the perimeter as far as pick and roll coverage. He's an okay rebounder. Same thing on Onuaku, you know, a beat him up guy, very physical. Played really well at Summer League with the Suns. Withy was a guy that I felt really was a lot like Robin Lopez before Robin got hurt, as far as better offensive rebounder than defensive rebounder, very mobile, you know, good rim protector. So you can kind of cobblestone between those three guys some modicum of a replacement value player or whatever you want to call it at center. But I think ultimately this team, again, it goes back to my original thing. This team is built to run teams out of their gym. That's how they're playing Tyreek at the three and Holiday and Gordon. and, you know, and then you play Anderson and Davis, and then when Gordon comes out, you know, or Holiday comes out, you put Morrow in, and, you know, or you put Evans at the one and Morrow at the three, and this is how they need to do it. And Jason Smith comes in for Anderson, and you always need a lot of spacing, a lot of shooting, and, you know, quick hitters. And if you want to play grind-it-out basketball and try and find minutes for real centers without having a real center on the roster, that's going to be tough. And even if they did that, you know, let's say they traded Anderson for Oshik, that's still tough. Still tough to play grind-it-out basketball with a guy that you can't throw the ball to offensively. Because ultimately, that's what we're looking at, right? We're looking at the guys they have, and we're saying, offensively, this works best for them. And that's an open court and an up-tempo style.
I agree, and I think we just found a Halloween idea for a lot of the kids out there, Steroid Man. I'll give that to a meme.
You know what? I misspoke. HGH. I'm so old. Steroids is... Steroids is like if you're in the 90s, the HGH is a thing right now.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I mean, with this last one, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be a little bit selfish here. Ask a question that I've always been, well, not always, last couple of years got more and more curious about. But it's something I know our readers and listeners and talk about a lot. And that's just this idea of, you know, national media. You're on the big stage now. You're writing pretty much exclusively for ESPN, and you cover everything. Ryan and I cover one team. We watch the same team for, you know, 82 games. We know everything about this team, and, you know, the little we know about Derek Favors or Larry Sanders comes from the three or four games we see them play, or, you know, maybe we catch a couple other games here and there randomly, but It's a different scope what you're looking at and what we're looking at, but I think fans and readers a lot of time get really frustrated by the, you know, the minor level of attention that small market teams get. I mean, if you look at New Orleans Pelicans season previews, I would say 80% of the national sites don't even have the correct starting lineup, which you could imagine how that infuriates a fan base to get something right. So basic wrong. And, you know, not to kiss butt. I know you said that earlier. I'm going to say the same back to you. Your columns personally for me are my favorite. And it's because you could tell there's a real attention to detail. You could tell you actually watch the games where I've seen other people, you know, it's obvious they just went to Synergy Sports, because I've read enough columns this summer that Robin Lopez is a good pick and roll defender just because Synergy says so, where Ryan and I know he's one of the worst in the league.
He used to be really good. That's all I can say. Robin's back injury really stopped him, you know. But we can get you. Go ahead with your question.
But I mean, he's terrible now. But anyway, so I guess I just want to ask you, as you know, as somebody whose job it is now to find different stories, find different angles, look at 30 teams, you know, try not to be too Laker heavy, even though that might get the clicks. I mean, you really seem to focus on almost every team and level of player. You personally, how much do you feel that you have to really know a player, know a team, have watched their games? Is there a games quota? Is there an hours quota? I mean, how much do you really feel until you feel justified in writing opinion on them or comparing this player versus that player now that you're on that stage? What's your personal criteria?
Well, a lot of it, you got to remember, you know, I work for a team, so I started from the video room. So game prep for these teams usually consisted of watching their last four or five games before we're about to play them. Although I'm not writing the scouting report, you know, I'm adding things to it sometimes. Sometimes I'm writing it in full. So, for instance, when I was a video coordinator, my first full year as a video coordinator came after the year I was interning. And when I was interning, I did a lot of college video. I was with the scouts all day long. So when I started the next season as a full-time video coordinator, and we're about to play guys, we're about to play Chicago. Nobody knew who Joakim Noah, or I won't say nobody, but you know, the scout, the advanced scout, the coaches, the head video guy, they were so ingrained in NBA. You know, they caught a couple of Florida games here and there, but they didn't really know about Joakim Noah's tendencies and stuff. So I had to write the Joakim Noah scouting report. I had to write the Corey Brewer scouting report. I had to write the Greg Oden scouting report, because these were guys that I watched extensively the year before. So kind of I've always had – I have like, you know, a bunch of years of experience of basically watching and prepping teams and things like that. And then, again, scouting guys and watching them and keeping track. So when I watch a guy like Austin Rivers, for instance, I've watched Austin Rivers since he was junior going on to be a senior in high school. So by the time he's to the pros, and I wrote that piece at the beginning of his rookie year before he'd even played only a handful of games, these are things I knew about Austin Rivers from watching him play, from, you know, scouting him on film and talking to people, doing my background research and all that. These are things I already knew about him. And there are a lot of people who are like, oh, you got to give him a chance. And actually, you know, it's because at Duke, I was like, no, I'm telling you things that he, as a junior in high school, he was doing. If he's still doing it now, that's who he is. You're not going to tell me that, oh, in the next couple of weeks, he'll get it right. The part of it is that it's already kind of an institutional knowledge that I already have because I've been watching for so long and following up and keeping tabs on guys. The other part of it is, watch a lot of basketball. I watch a lot of basketball. I don't know. I have League Pass and I have Synergy and I have regular cable and I watch as much basketball as I have. Another thing is also talking to people. A lot of it, you know, is, and this is, that's part of the business, how scouts do it. A lot of it is you're talking to the people who are on the ground, who are close to the situation. So in college, I talked to the assistant coaches at the college teams. Learn more about the players. And when you build a rapport and relationship with these people, they tell you things that may not be apparent when you watch it on film. It may not even be apparent if you go and watch them on practice. These are things that they're telling you that are, you know, below the surface, but they know because they're there day to day. Same thing with media people, talking to beat writers, talking to columnists, talking to bloggers. You know, it's impossible to build an opinion about every player in the league based solely on your own personal experience of, you know, of watching. Oh, because I watched and that's how I know. Yes, you definitely have to watch. Yes, you have to be versed with what they do well and what they don't do well. But the other part of it, there's going to be things that you're not going to pick up on from watching some Synergy or watching some film or whatever. You need to kind of be in the loop with someone who's got a pulse on the situation, not someone who's also kind of checking in and out like you are. And you know, I can't speak for other writers, but I do know what I've noticed is kind of what you've noticed is statistics have become a shorthand for people to kind of skip the process. You know, if you're going to evaluate a guy, you got to watch him. You got to watch him with context, which is something that Synergy doesn't do a great job of. You know, you just see the play. You see every pick and roll, which is good. Sometimes I want to see how he does in pick and rolls. But sometimes you also need that context of the game, which is, why did he do that on the pick and roll? Well, because the last three times, you know, with some other possessions, they were regarding it this way. So when we called timeout, we said, don't do that anymore. Even though that player wasn't involved in it, he's got his marching orders now. So you need that context sometimes from watching. You need the stats. You need to talk to people. You need everything. It's just like I would approach it as a front office executive. That's how I approach my writing.
I like it. I've, you know, since the first time I heard you on a podcast, and that, again, that's a kiss bud, and read your stuff, I got you as the next Michael Smith. Next ESPN guy on the come up, get big on TV, see you everywhere, and people come back to these podcasts. You are as well known, but no, I really appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, that's an absolutely fantastic way to look at it, though. As much as you know, you will still owe me a buffet of buffets pass next summer league, because the Warriors are not going to be nearly as good as you think they are.
No, I mean, it's true. Like, you guys know the Pelicans better than I do. I mean, that's a truth, you know, because like you said, you guys are watching in and out. You're going to practices and you're talking to, you know, you're interviewing people, you're interviewing players, you're interviewing people who cover the team, and you guys are on it every day. Whereas I watch the Pelicans game today, tomorrow I'm watching the Warriors, the next day I'm watching the Blazers, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I may be better at things as far as having an eye for things, evaluating and things like that, but it doesn't make up for that being current on the situation any more than you guys being there day to day makes up for not being able to notice things that I noticed as a scout. They all work hand in hand. And that's why, you know, I like coming on these podcasts, because I get to talk to you guys and I get to hear. And by the way, I'm not always, you know, I'm wrong sometimes. real modest there. But that's why I like to talk to you guys, because I like to hear your side of it and what you guys think. And you know, and I factor that in. And maybe sometimes that's to a detriment, and sometimes I have a little bit of that leaking into my writing, where I'm not necessarily doing 100% of my opinion, but I like to think that I can absorb information and use it in the right way.
Okay. I mean, we greatly appreciate coming on here, because, I mean, I always feel like somehow I'm missing stuff sometimes, and I always love to get, like, a scout's take on things. Especially when it comes to, like, these young players and how they could develop over time, because, you know, I always feel like I might be writing off people way too soon. Like, Austin Rivers here, I want to write him off. Michael keeps telling me I shouldn't.
I what I wrote about him last year, I've been saying the same thing for a while. He'll be good once he figures out that he's not God's gift. Is he going to figure that out? I don't know.
All right.
But if he does, then he can be a guard off the bench who can score and maybe spot you a little bit of combo guard. And, you know, kind of like Jared Bayless was the same way in high school and college. Say he thought he was God's gift to basketball, Jared Bayless, and got traded from place to place. He did a little stop in New Orleans, and they shipped him off five minutes after he got there.
Very quick.
And again, that was one. And I think they gave up a first-round pick to Portland to get him. And at the time, I was like, they didn't do their whole. If you did 5 minutes of homework on the kid's background, you'd know immediately he's not in the right mind state for you to be giving up a first-round pick for. Now, you look at him in Memphis, he's a good good contributor, because he's competitive, he's feisty, he can hit big shots, he gets a little bit in your shorts defensively. But it took him basically getting killed in three different cities to figure that out. Like, look, I'm just a random guy in this league, and I got to fight for my spot here, and no one's going to give it to me. And Austin Rivers, one day maybe he'll figure it out, or maybe he won't. Maybe he's going to go through lesson, man, they screwed me over. I should have been, you know who my dad is. I was the number one in high school, blah, 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 blah. I'm just as good as Kyrie and all. If he wants to play that way, then he'll never be anything more than what he is.
Real talk. That's what I would like Amin on this show. Thanks again so much for coming on. You know, hopefully when the Pelicans are the surprise of the league, we will bring you back on to give us some observations.
Yep.
Terrific. Can't wait.
Yeah, thanks for joining.
No problem.